This is the Good Things Guy podcast with myself, Brendan DeCue, South Africa's very own Good Things Guy. I'm on a mission to change what the world pays attention to. I truly believe that there's good news all around us, and I spend my time hunting down and reporting on the best good news stories from South Africa and the world. In the Good Things Guy podcast, you'll meet these everyday heroes and hear their incredible stories. Welcome back to the Good Things Podcast, where we celebrate all the stories that lift us up. I'm Brendan DeCue, your host, and today's episode is a special one. We've got someone truly remarkable with us. She's a real-life hero, a South African legend who's done more than just push boundaries. She's completely redefined them, whether it's tackling some of the world's most challenging terrains or championing mental health and resilience. Her journey is nothing short of inspiring. Please join me in welcoming the incredible Kirsten Landman. Not the first time you've been on the show. Welcome back, Kirsten. It's absolutely a privilege to have you with us again.
Oh, thank you so much, Brent, and thank you for that very incredible introduction. You make me sound very good.
That's exactly what you are. You are so inspirational. And before hitting record, I did say it's been a while since you and I were in studio chatting. But I have to ask, perhaps for our listeners that are living under a rock and haven't heard about your incredible story, let's start at the very beginning. How did you get into biking, and how did you make this your professional career?
So as anything does with, I think, anyone who's passionate about something and a professional athlete, starts off as fun. I'm tomboy at the age of seven at the time, and grew up pretty close with my cousin, and he got his first bike at the age of four, and I was seven. Saw his motorbike and I fell in love. And I was training for the provincial Southern Gauteng swimming squad at the time, and I started asking my dad, can I get a bike? Can I learn to ride? Can I ride Stefan's bike, who was my cousin? And I kind of just kept nagging and nagging and nagging. And eventually he said to me, if you make the swimming squad, I'll buy you a motorbike. And I've been really challenged. I love a challenge. And I won the bet and got my first bike at the age of eight. And that was it. It was just love. And when I woke up, all I wanted to do was ride. I don't think my father thought I would have taken it so seriously, not in the sense that taking it seriously to be this professional athlete, but just because all I wanted to do was eat, sleep, ride, and repeat. That was my day in, day out. And it became a bit more competitive when I started entering races, never with the goal to like win, but just because we grew up in the northern suburbs and we had a place where we could go ride literally around the corner from our house. And then they started hosting races and I started entering races and doing quite well against the guys because there were never ever women's classes. Kind of got good towards the end of high school, and I picked up my first sponsor in grade 11. Nothing serious, but just, you know, some sort of support. And then my parents gave me a gap year out of school. And in that gap year, I got very gratefully was given a car and a bike from them. And they said, okay, you're on your own now. If you want to be able to carry on with the sport, because we can't fund it anymore, got to get the sponsors. And that year I worked really hard on my training, trying to go to as many races as possible while working at the same time and supporting myself to get to the races. And then I picked up my sponsor the next year, 2011, 2012. I got my first factory sponsor in South Africa with Bidvest Yamaha. And that was the start of it all. You know, I got the support to race competitively. And then in 2013, it's kind of when it really kicked off, when I got picked up by KTM South Africa. And that was the start of, I would say, my professional career.
I'm going to pause you there because I've got a question that's going to lead into 2013. But I wanted to ask, what does a day in the life of a professional motorcycle athlete look like?
Ooh, the day in the life of the 21-year-old professional athlete, Kirsten, and the 33-year-old Kirsten is very different. But you know what it is? It's we wake up, we train, whether it be in the gym, doing strength work. If I go out on the road on the bicycle, I'll do a 2 to 3 hour cycle, or on the indoor trainer, weather dependent, or I'll ride my motorbike. I try to ride my motorbike 2 to 3, 4 times a week at most, but generally doing something every day. Like I say, the 21-year-old, I was training 2-3 times a day. The 33-year-old can't do that anymore because I'm sitting with every bloody injury under the sun, and I've got to watch my heart rate, and I can't train too much. So, you know, now I'm only training once a day, but really, you know, making sure that once a day is really a good 2 to 3 hour session, and I'm making the most of it. A lot has changed over my career due to the physicality demanding parts of the sport, which has been a real learning lesson and coping mechanism over all the years that I've been competing.
So when I was younger, I had a little ATCC. My brothers had a bike, and my dad had obviously his off-road. And I know what it's like to be in the saddle for an hour. You get off that bike, and it takes all muscles and control. So I can just imagine a couple of hours on the bike, what that does. If we now look at 2013 and some of those aches and pains, you had a major, major accident, which sort of changed your career, or sort of paused it for a bit, right?
Yeah, it changed my life in many ways. You know, at the time it was very frustrating. I was racing in Botswana. It was my first year I signed on with KTM. So, you know, you go there with pressure that you've got to impress, and, you know, you've got to keep sponsors happy, because in the day they're paying. And if you keep crashing or if you get injured, then you seem to think that, oh, are they going to re-sign? So I felt like I had to prove a lot coming onto the team, and 6 months into racing with the team, I'm not sure if I was going to survive, let alone ride again. So yeah, I severed my pancreas with my small intestine, and that resulted in all my organs going septic because we were racing in Botswana, and unfortunately I wasn't in the hands of very good medical care. Mm. Then only coming home and being treated 36 hours later is what caused the sepsis and what made the accident so life-threatening. I was put into an induced coma for 2 weeks. I was on life support for 11 days. In saying that, at the time, I was very frustrated when I woke up, and why did this happen to me? And, you know, I had a lot of questions to the higher being that I believed in at the time, and very frustrated and hurt and angry. But as I've got older, and, you know, I look back at that accident now, and it was a blessing in my eyes, because I had gone into, you know, racing, I was so serious. Never spent time with my friends, never spent time with my family. I had this false, you know, idea of what it took to be a professional athlete, because this is what I thought a professional athlete needs to do, was, you know, eat, sleep, train, repeat. I had no balance. It was, everything was thrown into my racing. And eventually I actually stopped having fun doing my racing. And then at the same time, I was also going through a very big transition in my life with my sexuality. Mm-hmm. I knew I was gay. But I was dealing with, would sponsors be accepting of me being gay if I came out? Would my family be accepting of me if I came out? And I'd met a girl 3 months before my accident. Needed to tell my parents because they saw I was spending all this time with her. And I had my accident. And then I woke up from this accident. And as soon as I woke up, I said to myself, if I had died, that person that had been closeted and not living my true self, it would have been so disappointed. And here I am, second chance at life. If you don't like who I am and you're not going to accept who I am, life is short. And I just realized that, and I was going to live life to the fullest. So it was a huge awakening in many ways. I changed my whole training regime, had a whole new outlook on life. I mean, I told my family, friends, sponsors, parents. I mean, I didn't come out with a gay flag attached to my, or stuck on my helmet, but to those that mattered, they knew, and they all kind of like, we all already knew. So when I say it was a blessing, it was just really an awakening, in the sense that it was me to start living my true self and really living life. And that's what I've done every day since.
Kirst, I have to tell you that I like 33-year-old Kirst, because the last time, the last time we had this conversation, I don't think we went as deep. It was
no, we didn't.
That's incredibly special, and I'm bloody happy for you. Tell me, how did you get back on the bike, right? So now we've got this whole reassessment of life. We're looking at it from a different perspective. How do you proverbially get back on the horse?
As soon as I woke up, the first thing I smiled as my mom, I don't remember, I was so gooped on all the medication. First thing my mom and my sister said, I asked, was, is my bike okay? Of course it was okay. And I think that's also the reason why I made such a quick recovery. My doctors were quite shocked at the fact that, hey, I survived. And then the recovery as to how quickly I turned around. But I think I turned around too quickly, because 6 weeks post coming out of hospital, I actually reversed my small intestine due to a complication from the trauma from the first accident. And then it kind of like, because I was moving too fast. Then my body again was like another little message. Like, whoa, Kirst, slow down. Give your body time to recover. Because I was like, I need to get fit. I need to get strong. I mean, I had lost 12 kilos I was so weak. I was so sick, but I was just that mentality, push, push, push. And then I was brought back down to earth and being like, well, chick, take your time and give your body some grace and let it come back in its own time. I only got back on the bike 6 months later. It took me 6 months to regain my strength, build my muscle. I've got a 25 centimeter scar across my stomach where they cut me open, and I mean they go straight through your main muscles in your abdomen. So you had to learn to kind of, you know, gain my strength, and your core is where all your muscle comes from. So mentally I was like, yes, I can't wait to get back on the bike. But physically my body was just like, it really needed time. I was only back on the bike that year, December. So I had the accident in June. I was 6 months later I got back on the bike.
But I mean, you haven't got off since, and you've been racking up the awards, and the sort of things that you've been doing is unreal. If we take a step back to one of the toughest races on earth, right? Dakar. What year was it? 2020?
2020.
And what would inspire someone to take on one of the toughest races on earth?
I don't know. I think it's a little bit of stupidity. I laughed because I think back to it now and I'm like, what were you thinking? But I mean, there I am getting ready for my third one now. Really ticked all the boxes in hard enduro, which is my discipline of off-road racing. That's it's my favorite. It's where I feel I do best, and it's what I enjoy the most. And I had had a really good successful career in 2016, doing all the internationals and being the first female to finish all the hard enduro races. In 2017, I won a South African championship against the men, which hadn't been done before on the motorbikes. And then I was in an interview. He listed everything that I'd done. And he's like, what's next?
Yeah.
And I didn't know. I was just like, oh, really? What is next? Like, you've kind of reached the pinnacle in your career of hard enduro, and you've done really well in South African racing. What is next? And I mean, I've watched Dakar. I've been a Dakar fan since as far back as I can remember. I remember every year it's Christmas, and then January it's Dakar. And that was when the seed was planted. I started looking into it, chatting to guys within the South African motorbiking fraternity, chatting more about it, looking at the numbers. And then I chatted to my boss, Francisca, at KTM South Africa. And she said to me, listen, Kirst, no disrespect. I know you've definitely got what it takes, but you haven't done an off-road since 2013, which was the last off-road that I did, was the one I crashed at. She says, you stick to the hard enduro because you're scared of going fast. If you want to go to the Dakar, you've got to learn to go fast again, and you've got to overcome this fear of racing high speed, which is to the desert 1000, and finish that race that you haven't done. And that for me was like, oh, I got this lump in my throat. And because I was terrified, like Brent, I wouldn't go over fourth, wouldn't get out of fourth gear on a motorbike. That's why I went to the hard enduro stuff, because it's really slow. It's really technical. Yeah. I mean, some of our races, we average 10 kilometers an hour. It's slow. It's physical. You'll have a fast section, but it's 90% really technical up and down. There's not fast sections. And that's why I honed in on the technical stuff, because I was so terrified of high speed from my accident.
Was this a conscious thing that you knew was going on? Did you know that you had made this 100%. Conscious decision?
I was that's why I swore to myself to never go back to Botswana. Nothing against Botswana, but just because of that fear, that whole series of my accident, I was like, not going back to Botswana, never going fast again. I'm never doing any high speed racing again in my life. And that's why I always enjoyed the hard enduro, but now it like became even more, I'll only ever do hard enduro because I don't ever want to be put into that situation of a high speed accident again, or, you know, have that life threatening, because the accidents are a lot higher in off-road racing because you're going fast and you're riding in dust. And that's also why Dakar is such a dangerous race, because of the high speeds and the dust and everything that comes with off-road racing.
You're telling me everything that was telling you not to do it, and then you did
it. Exactly. But this is me. This is my problem. Like, someone must tell me I can't do something, and I will do everything in my power to prove to you that I can. And now I'm now this conflicting idea in my own head. Like, you don't ever want to go fast again. You're so scared. But at the same time, I started to analyze my racing, and I had got to a point where I was going fast, but I wasn't going fast enough, because what was holding me back was, I could ride technical really well, but the moment I got to sections where it was faster, I would fall off the pace, and then I would catch the guys again in the technical and then lose them again in the faster stuff. And I was like, this is affecting your hard endurance, it's affecting your results. You need to be a faster rider, and you actually need to be a better all-round rider. And my speed was lacking because I had this like monkey on my shoulders holding me back because I was so scared to go fast. Like, I promise you, I wouldn't go out of fourth gear. 60 kilometers an hour, that was it. And like, how can you be a racer and not want to go faster than 60 kilometers an hour? So I thought, okay, if we do the Dakar, I've now got to go and conquer all of my biggest fears. If I could finish the Desert 1000, go back to Botswana, race the Desert 1000, then I could do the Dakar. And that was it. So with Francisca and at the time, the Brother Broadlink KTM team, 2018. We're back in Gaborone racing the Desert 1000. And I was 100% fine before a week before the event, strong, fit. And then that mental drain. I don't know if this has ever happened to you before, but you know when you get so worked up about something, I made myself physically ill. Mm. I had, by the time we arrived at the race, I had full-blown flu just because of like how scared I was, crying on the way to the race in the car, sweating, scared. I mean, that night before the race, before we started racing, it's 2 days. It's called the Toyota Desert 1000 because you do 500 kilometers over 2 days of racing. And I shouldn't have raced because I was so sick, but I was like, I can't, I'm not letting this hold me back anymore. I've got to do this. And I got through the race and I finished. And, you know, amongst all my incredible achievements that I've done all over the world, finishing that race is amongst the highest and my best achievements, because the moment I crossed that finish line, Bryony, my wife, was at the finish line. I just burst into tears and I felt like the weight of the world, all of that fear and all of that trauma from your accident. You've got over it, and hey, chick, you're going to the Dakar Rally, because that for me was like, if I can get through that, I can go to the Dakar. And that was the start of the campaign. We came out in August of 2018, Women's Month, and we put out my Dakar campaign video to get sponsors on board. And in January 2020, we were at Dakar and we finished, and it was incredible. And you know what's so hectic about being at that Dakar branch? It was terrifying. But everything I feared from racing, you know, death, dust, high speeds, you know, I went into this race terrified. You know, not just because you've got a 2.8 million rand contract relying on this, you know, they've spent all this money, you've got to bloody finish. Yeah, every day when I say goodbye to Brian, he asks, I may sound dramatic, but this is what's going through my mind. I don't know if I'll see you again. You know, and you riding and you racing and there's helicopters. The moment you see a helicopter, there's 9 out of 10 times there's an accident. And at that deck, there were 2 deaths. So you're riding 2 helicopters now and there's a body bag. And then you just question, why am I here? Why am I doing this cursed? And you just question every reason, like, you stupid, why are you here? When you survived it, you got through it, you're healthy, and again, you're putting yourself in this horrible situation. But I mean, you know, I just think again, that was my healing, that was my journey into moving past that trauma, you know, maybe hadn't really truly dealt with after my accident. But I mean, this is racing and this is the nature of the sport. It's off-road, it's enduro, it's motorsport, it's dangerous, and it happens. But then crossing the finish line at the Dakar again, it was just an incredible feeling.
When you finished in 2020, you became the first African woman to finish the rally on a motorcycle. No one else can say they've done that. And you ended third among the women's overall finishers. Like, no one, you did that. And that feeling of crossing that finish line is why you do it. It feeds your soul.
That's exactly it. It's everything that you go through it. My crossing the finish line in 2020 was everything I've done since 8-year-old girl. And that makes it all worth it, you know. It's not like you just wake up. You've been on a bike for 2 years and you're like, hey, I want to go to the Dakar. It doesn't work out like that. It's like the wiser you get as a rider and the more experienced you become, only then later on in your career do you decide to go to the Dakar, because it's not like it's a 2-day race. It's 14 days you're doing. I find Dakar is the biggest mental game that I've ever played. It's like, I call it, it's like the Hunger Games. All the odds are against you.
And then you went and did it again in 2023.
On my own.
On your own.
Stupider.
On your own. talk us through, I'm going to say this wrong, the Malimoto, is that how you say it?
Malimoto, yeah. And it's been renamed the original by Motul Klos, which goes back to the translation of Malimoto is, Malé is a trunk in French and moto being motorbike. And it originates back to when Dakar first started 44 years ago, when it used to go from Paris to Dakar. And they never had support crews back then. I mean, the first Dakar race that took off, there were only like 30 or 40 competitors, and they didn't know if it was going to be this big race. But I mean, they were doing these massive distances, and there was no such thing as teams. It'd be like, carry everything you can on the bike, get to the bivouac. There'll be something stationed there for you. There might be food, there might not be food. So carry food, carry tools. Here's your road book. And that's what the Dakar was like.
Go out there and do your best.
That's it. Yeah. We see you. If we don't, we might send someone to come and find you. And they've kind of kept the class going. Obviously, it's got a lot safer and a lot more advanced. But the rules of the original bimotual is you've got one 80-liter trunk that they give you, a metal trunk. You've got your bike. You're allowed to take a spare set of a front and back wheel. And they give you a bike stand, a bike mat, and tools, like power tools within the bivouac where we pit, which you have access to, and oils. And then they give you a tent and a mattress, and that's it. Peace out. Have fun. You know, you can get assistance from fellow riders in the Malemoto, in the original bimotual team. So we enter as a team because we all stay in the same place, but no one's allowed to help you. Like Bryony came with, she comes with me to my Dakars, and she was sitting on the chair watching me. And I remember it was like stage 8, and I had hurt my back in the June. Right. Getting up and sitting down was really sore. And though my tool that I wanted to get was on the other side of the bike, and I'm so tired, my back's sore, and she was sitting there watching me, and she couldn't even pass me. You're not even allowed to pass me the tool. And I was so tired, I just started crying. She got up and left. She's like, this is torture. I'm leaving. I can't watch you and not be able to help you. But that's just how, you know, you enter the class to do it on your own, and they're really strict. I mean, you get back from riding the bike from 4 o'clock in the morning till like 6-7 o'clock at night. You've got to put, as soon as you get back, you park your bike. You got to go put your tent up. While I'm putting up my tent, I'm quickly trying to have a recovery shake and drink water. And then I'm taking my kit off, hanging it out to dry, setting up my tent. And then what I'll do is I'll quickly go eat food in the dining hall, bring my food back with me, and then I start working on my bike. Oil change, chain check, all nuts and bolts. If I had anything that I was worried about during the day that I wasn't happy with, I would check that. But luckily, that's one thing that I have been really good with over my career, is I've been really soft on the motorbike. So I'm not a, you know, if you break it, you got to fix it.
Yeah.
So at Dakar, I was very lucky. I had very few mechanicals. So just the basics every day. But just doing the basics every day took me 2 hours. So, I mean, every night you're getting into bed in your lovely tent, and it's noisy, and it rained, like torrential rain. So you're now contending with rain, water getting everywhere, your kit doesn't dry, it's freezing cold. That's what I said, it's just a mind game. Just when you think you're all right, something happens, and then, you know, the fatigue starts to set in, and then you start making small mistakes, like I forgot to screw on my oil cap. I get to the start line, and my oil cap's missing off my motorbike. And it's just things like that, you know, things that you wouldn't make on a normal day. But when you've ridden for 9-10 days in a row and you've averaged 10 hours a day on the bike, you start making stupid mistakes. And I think that's why the original bimotual is the hardest category to race at the Dakar.
The hardest. And even though you were going through all those things that year, you still managed to stop and help a fellow Dakar rider, Michel, I think his name was. And you got called, got named as a hero of the Dakar. And I guess, I mean, we've spoken about what you've been through in your career, that accident that you had in 2013. You could feel that pain of being in an accident, and you stopped your race to assist him.
So Michelle's actually a really good friend of mine. I've made friends. We did 2020 together, and we've stayed in contact. I went over in 21, trained with him. And we've always kept in contact. And then we rode quite a bit, 2023, the first 2 days, I think, we were riding together. And that whole morning, I mean, that oak knows the dunes backwards. He is Saudi Arabian, so he knows how to read dunes exceptionally well. And he came past me, and he like pointed to me, and he said, come with me. And we were riding so nicely together, and he navigates really well. And we had passed so many riders. And I mean, if I was in front, I would have made that mistake, because you can't see it. And as soon as I saw it, my heart just shattered, because anyone at the Dakar, they have made so many sacrifices to get there. And whether you be on a team and you've got it all paid for, or you're a privateer like myself, he had just recovered from an injury. It was just heartbreaking, and I was upset for him because you come into Dakar and to get injured is so sad. And I would have stopped for anyone. That is just, and I think that's how everyone is at the Dakar. We've just got this rider etiquette, and it doesn't matter how long it takes. It's the priority of the rider comes first.
Absolutely, and now we're getting into the mental game of maybe not being a hero, but getting back into the seat of Dakar 2025. Mm-hmm.
I love it. Every time I leave the Dakar, I'm like, I don't ever want to do that stupid race again. And then you're home for 3 weeks, and then you get what you call Dakar blues, and you're pumped. You're like, okay, I'm ready. Let's do this. And it's not just the Dakar that makes me want to go back. It's this scrum that I'm in now, Brent, where I'm hustling for money to try and get there. And it's the excitement, like, are we going to make it? Can we get the sponsors? You know, what are we going to do? And then it's the build up. It's the excitement. It's the excitement of getting South Africa behind you, because I get messaged day in and day out, hope to see you back at the Dakar. So yeah, it's a collective of things. What we want to do this year is we want to take a cameraman, videographer, photographer with us. And I want them to capture every moment from the moment I wake up till the moment I go to sleep of what it takes to do the original bimotor class from a female's point of view. And we will be putting that onto a YouTube channel, but there will be a daily vlog of each stage of the Dakar, the emotional side of that, the camaraderie within the original bimotor category, where everyone's really helpful and you become like this family. And then the highs, the lows, people can see what it takes. And I want to bring people along for the journey, because it's a bit more of a personal journey. I can't explain it. You either have to be there, and I think the closest thing for people to be there is to give them a vlog.
What did I say? You're a South African legend who's doing more than just pushing boundaries. You're completely redefining them. And I think having this backstory that people can follow, being able to watch what happens behind the scenes, it's going to give us insights, not just into what you have to do to get through a Dakar, but what all the other riders have to do as well. And I'm super amped to be following that. Obviously, Good Things Guy will repost and reshare and put out articles to support you as much as we can. But Kirst, if people want to follow your journey, or if perhaps there's a corporate that's listening right now, a brand who might want to give you sponsorship, how do they get hold of you?
So the easiest way to get hold of me on all my socials is just to go straight to my website. It's www.kirstenlandman.com. There's a direct contact page which comes straight to me, my cell phone number, email address, a bit more information about me, who I am, what I've done, and what the plans are for the year, and obviously for Dakar 2025. Everything's there. If anyone's listening, please reach out. If you know of anyone, please forward my contact details onto them. This year, we're going to have to do a collective chuck all the pennies into a pot, and you know, if that gets me to the start line, then that gets me to the start line. So any bit helps, and everyone looks at the whole number. Don't look at the whole. I mean, if we start throwing in rands, we will get to the whole. So if I can, you know, get the message to anyone, please, just anything will help. And if we spread it far and wide, which you guys have done so well with my whole career, and you share everything, and I'm really, really grateful.
Thank you. Celebrating good things. Kirsten Ludman, I'm excited to follow your journey. We're going to put a link inside this podcast to where you can go and follow and get in touch with Kirst. It's been absolutely incredible having you on the show. I cannot wait to catch up when you're back from Dakar.
Oh, I can't wait to chat, and we'll have lots of stories, and hopefully you would have been able to watch every day and enjoy the, I think you guys will enjoy a lot more than I do, but you can be a part of the journey this time, which is what I want to bring to South Africa, which is really cool.
That's it. Wishing you only good things. And for more good things, visit www.goodthingsguy.com. Okay? Love you. Bye.